Welcome to Discovering Nutrition with Chronometer. I am your host and community marketing manager, Elisa, and today I am so thrilled to have on sleep expert, Dr. Rebecca Robbins. Dr. Robbins is an instructor in medicine at Harvard Medical School and an associate scientist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Her research uses marketing and novel communication tools and technologies like smartphones and other mobile devices to design persuasive behavior change interventions to improve sleep and circadian health. As always, this podcast is for general purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including getting medical advice. The use of information from this podcast is at the user's own risk and is not to be substituted for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Now, without further ado, let's bring on Dr. Robbins and learn about sleep.
One of the first questions that I think everybody wants to know is how many hours of sleep should we actually be getting every night?
Great question. Now, we're in the field of sleep, really trying to move away from a hyper focus on sleep duration. Of course, sleep duration is a critical part of a healthy sleep routine, but it is just one part of our overall sleep health. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But to answer your question, ideally, adults are getting consistently between 7 and 9 hours of sleep at night. And that's ideally in one consolidated period. So I shouldn't say at night, I should say in a 24-hour period. Can we actually scratch all of that? Because it's actually more nuanced. Adults ideally are sleeping between 7 and 9 hours in one consolidated bout of time. Now, where are you on that spectrum? Some people say, you know, I sleep 7, but I feel, you know, wake up and feel terrible. So all of us are in part genetically hardwired to have a number of hours that suits us best. If you had two parents that were somewhat shorter sleepers, you might be among the lucky that do well on 7 hours. But conversely, if you had two longer sleeping parents, you might really do better on closer to 9 hours of sleep. So the key is finding out where you are in that range. And there are a couple ways to do that. So the key is being clear about how much sleep you're getting right now. And often we'll subtract our bedtime from the time our alarm goes off, and then we'll view that as sleep. But it actually takes even the well-rested person about 20 minutes to fall asleep. And we often don't include that into our estimate of how long we're sleeping. So this is where things like sleep trackers can be really beneficial to give you a really good sense objectively of how much sleep you're actually getting because of that time that it takes us to fall asleep. So once you pin down exactly, you know, or really how much you're getting, how many hours of actual sleep, then ask yourself these two questions. When you wake up in the morning, do you feel refreshed by your sleep? Or do you feel like you're reaching for the snooze bar and, you know, desperate for a little bit more? And then how do you feel in the afternoon? Those two questions can be really useful because if you're meeting your sleep need, you are going to feel refreshed in the morning, wake up, not need the alarm clock, and able to go about your day. If you're not getting enough sleep, you're going to be tired. You're going to want to reach for the snooze bar and sleep in a little bit. And then conversely, in the afternoon, same thing. So if you're not meeting your sleep need, you're likely going to be sleepy in the afternoon and kind of, you know, reach for an extra cup of coffee. So if that is you, consider adding a little bit more sleep to your overall sleep schedule. And now the best way to do that is not to say, all right, tonight I'm going to get into bed 2 hours early. We could all probably agree that if you've ever done that, it's kind of a recipe for insomnia because our brain in part governs our sleep. We're going to get into that, but that system does not move very easily, you know, with sweeping changes to our schedule. So we need to move slowly and ideally add time on the bedtime is part of our sleep routine. So simply moving our bedtime earlier, about 15 minutes, and try that for a few nights. And then just check in again. How do you feel in the morning and how do you feel in the afternoon? And if you're able to say, you know, I feel pretty good, I'm able to get out of bed in the morning and then power through in the afternoon, that's a good sign that you've hit your sleep need.
I love that. One of the interesting things for me personally, because I've really focused on adequate rest. I started wearing an Oura ring about 4 years ago. And I was like, noticing days I would perform a lot better. I obviously had better sleep. My resting heart rate was lower and that kind of thing. So I definitely started paying attention. I'm fortunate with our work here at Chronometer that I am a little bit of a morning person. I do get a jump on the day. Most people start at 9, but I go to bed a reasonable time and just don't even have an alarm, which is a very rare thing. But I find myself, depending on what time I went to bed, just waking up naturally, which is so nice to just avoid that snooze button altogether.
That is great. Alisa, that's the holy grail.
I feel so lucky. So,
well, you now know, I'm sure awesome. After, and I'd love to hear all of that. Mm-hmm. Those really awesome changes. I think trackers can be overwhelmingly positive and really mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, if you're trying to improve your weight and, mm-hmm. you know, working on a nutrition plan, of course, this is all of your stuff at Chronometer. Yeah. But then a scale can be a helpful metric to give you some objective feedback of where you are and your weight. Of course, you know, not perfect for everyone. That's stressful for some people, but simply the notion of providing some objective information on where you are when it comes to sleep can be beneficial especially when you're trying to kind of initiate healthy changes and new habits. And so if you wake up and you don't feel great and you look at your Oura data and you're like, man, you know, I didn't get enough sleep. I didn't, you know, hit all the sleep stages. Then what's so valuable about that is it prompts this process of self-reflection. And then mm-hmm. you automatically start to like reflect on what happened yesterday. And, you know, was it that last cup of coffee or was I working too late? Was I on screens up until my bedtime? And all of those little kind of behavioral reflections are so powerful and so much more powerful than someone, you know, pointing their finger at us and saying, you should sleep and get in bed. Behavior change is much more organic and sustainable when it comes from the person.
I think that that's the only thing that I truly attribute to making me focus on sleep was wearing a wearable. And when it comes to nutrition tracking, which is obviously what we do, you know, you can't track what you're not measuring. So for me, like, I love data. I might be one of the only people that's very, very driven by data. But for me, I was like, oh my goodness, when I see the proof of, you know, even like my heart rate and my HRV, which is heart rate variability, and even my mood and those kinds of things, when I get like 5 hours of sleep, I'm like, I'm one of those people that needs closer to 9. But that's a great segue to our next question. And you kind of have touched on this, so that's amazing already. But what impacts how much sleep you actually get in any given night? I'm sure there's a number of variables, but is there like a secret recipe?
It's a really good question. Now, there are a couple, of course, things that, you know, are relevant to that question. The first is, we've talked about this briefly, but really the kind of the magical number that we need by and large, most nights of the week, is in part genetically determined. It's somewhere between that 7 and 9 hour range that we talked about. But there are things that we, you know, reasons that we could maybe need a little bit more sleep. There are certainly life stages where we get less sleep, not necessarily that we need less sleep, such as being a mother or a father mm-hmm. of a new child or caring for an older adult or menopause or older men with prostate issues. There are certainly some groups that get a little bit less than maybe their body needs. But on the other end, there are also times where what we do over the course of the day might result in a little bit more sleep need at night. For instance, if you do a really tough workout, your body might need a little bit more rest. And so just being mindful of what you do during the day. And if you did go for a 20-mile run, realizing that it might be a good idea to crawl in between the sheets a little bit earlier than usual.
And what happens if you're not getting adequate sleep long-term? Obviously, there's, you know, you could go on vacation, say, and you're suffering from jet lag and that's impeding your sleep. But what happens when people start going, you know, a month with sleep deprivation or longer?
Great question. Now, as you touched on, there are lots of consequences in the short term. We all know these all too well. You wake up and you're just kind of experiencing brain fog. You know, your brain is just fuzzy. You're not as productive. You're not as dynamic. You're less able to come up with creative solutions to complex problems than we are when we're well rested. And now that's in the shorter term, but in the longer term, we do see an increased risk for a couple domains. So let's touch on the first, and that's mental health concerns. When we're not getting enough sleep and enough good quality sleep that allows us to wake up and feel restored, what happens is we are less able to do something called perspective taking. So kind of taking events from the day that are kind of abstract when you think about it, truly, you know, events in the, you know, alone aren't necessarily stressful, but it's our reaction to them that then ascribes emotion to them. When we kind of add a layer of meaning or perspective onto those that might cause stress or leave us feeling frustrated or sad, but we're less able to go through the process of, you know, taking in events and taking them with a grain of salt, so to say. And so that can, over time, accumulate, and then we can be more and more prone to more negative affect and less perspective taking. And then that together puts us at greater risk for mental health concerns, such as feelings of depression and anxiety. And then there is a bidirectional relationship between the experience of anxiety and depression and sleep itself, so that the experience of those emotions when we're experienced, or more likely, the area of mental health is also a concern when it comes to the conversation about poor sleep. So when we're not getting enough rest, we're a little bit more prone to negative affect and maybe taking events out of context. And then in the longer term, that leaves us more likely for anxiety and depression. But then there's also, unfortunately, a bidirectional relationship between those feelings and our sleep. So when we're experiencing more of those feelings, then the next night rolls around and we're going to struggle. So there's this really dangerous bidirectional relationship between mental health and sleep.
Another Maybe domain. That's why I'm happy all the time.
There we go.
Lisa, I sleep a lot.
I love it. Key ingredient to a happy, positive outlook. I really am a believer in that too.
Absolutely. Are there physical ramifications to not getting enough sleep? I love touching on the mental health side, because I really believe, like, I've seen the impact myself. I say I'm a different person if I sleep 5 hours or if I sleep, you know, 8 or 9, like, everything does feel so much easier. But is less sleep linked to disease or any ailments?
Yeah. So in addition to the short-term implications we talked about and the impact of sleep on mental health, other areas are also impacted. So in the broad category of physical health, we see, on the one hand, heart health is impaired when we're not getting enough sleep and enough good quality sleep. Something fascinating happens during sleep where our blood pressure actually dips to its lowest point in the 24-hour day. And that dipping is really important to allow us to wake up and maintain a healthy blood pressure. So if we're not getting the maximum benefit of that natural dipping of blood pressure that allows us to maintain homeostasis and a healthy BP during wakefulness, then what's going to happen over time is that's going to place us at an increased risk for a constantly elevated blood pressure. And then subsequently, things like hypertension and heart disease could also follow. Insufficient sleep has also been linked with longer-term concerns, heart disease, cardiovascular disease, et cetera. So then in addition to the heart health benefits, we also have fascinating evidence that sleep and our immune system are linked. So research has shown that in samples of healthy adults, when one condition is allowed to get healthy sleep, so they're able to sleep for the full, you know, 7, 8, or 9 hours, and another condition is deprived of sleep, and they're deprived to fewer than 6 hours of sleep, that sleep-deprived condition, when compared, both groups, by the way, were exposed directly to viral pathogens, the rhinovirus, and this is a sister pathogen to SARS-CoV-2, but this is the pathogen that results in colds and flu. So both groups received this direct context. I always joke, don't sign up for this study. Not a good one to volunteer for. But the sleep deprived.
Not sound like it.
Yeah, don't go for this one if you can help it. But maybe the participants were compensated well. But anyway, the sleep deprived condition had almost 3 times more colds and flu than the well rested condition. So often we think, you know, oh, I'm working so hard. No wonder I got sick. But really, it's not, of course, the hard work. It's the fact that during periods when our students are working hard and they're in exams, or when we ourselves are working hard and our professional lives take control, you know, deadlines spike, that type of thing, what often is happening is that we're not getting enough sleep. So sleep is really implicated in our immune function, as it turns out, and that which we learn from this study. We also are uncovering...
Go ahead. Sorry. I did have a question about that, but please go ahead.
No. Okay. Well, one last thing, and then we can go to questions. But the other really fascinating area of the research is uncovering that our sleep each and every night might play an important role in our ability to fend off cognitive decline. There are toxic particles that build up in the brain. They simply accrue as a result of our processing information. And what's so fascinating, we now know that during sleep, those toxic particles are removed from the brain at an accelerated rate as compared to wakefulness. So we believe, therefore, that each and every night, this removal of toxins and the accelerated rate at which that happens might actually play a small role over time in reducing our risk for neurocognitive decline and things like Alzheimer's disease and dementia.
That is amazing. If people don't get 7 to 8 hours of sleep after this podcast episode, then make sure you can prioritize sleep. This is so interesting to me.
But you know, the truth is, a lot of people are struggling, and I almost you know, we often recount all of these scary things. But the important message is that, and we're going to get into this, Elisa. But the important message is that you're not alone. And many people are struggling. It's truly just part of the fabric of the human condition, because we all experience stress. And so we're all going to experience sleep difficulties from time to time. But the very good news is there are so many behavioral tips and changes that we can make to our daily schedules and routines that offer big benefit to our sleep.
Yeah, I noticed, so I've done a bunch of sleep research this month because it is sleep month for us at Chronometer. And I noticed that there's a lot of attention right now on creating an optimal sleep environment. Is that something that you think has benefit? So when the research that I did, it was saying, you know, maybe keep your dogs and cats out of your bed, make sure you have blackout curtains, pay attention to temperature. Do you think that there is benefit to creating a sleep environment?
100%. I love talking about the bedroom, because truly, sometimes it's hard to change our behavior. You know, resist another glass of wine, or, you know, cut out caffeine. Sometimes those behavior changes are hard, but I like to joke that the bedroom is kind of a gateway drug to healthier sleep habits overall, because if your bedroom is not in good shape, your sleep is definitely going to suffer. But often the changes to our bedroom environment are really actually, in many cases, small tweaks, like making sure your curtains close. If your curtains have a little gap in between them, that means light could get in and interfere with your sleep. So, you know, there are little simple hacks, like you can just get a clothespin and make sure that your curtain, you know, that allows your curtains to close. So I like to joke, the bedroom is a really wonderful place to start when you're thinking about healthy changes to your overall sleep routine. And ideally, the bedroom is really a sanctuary to your sleep. And I know that sounds a little bit cheesy, but, you know, I really want you to walk into your bed and feel at ease. We have more stress in our lives than ever, and our lives seem to get more and more complex, and there's so much going on in the world around us. And your bedroom ideally is a place where you walk in, you feel relaxed, and you feel ready to soothe yourself and go to sleep. So, but too often the bedroom honestly is not that way. Often there are, you know, cable boxes with bright lights, there are chargers, it's not the right temperature, it's stuffy, you know, your mattress is old, your pillows aren't, you know, supportive. So I want you to walk into your bedroom tonight, everyone listening, and ask yourself, you know, what is stressing me out? Is it a bright alarm clock that stresses you out when you wake up at night? I mean, that's so stressful. If you have a bright alarm clock, you know, blaring that it's 2 a.m., of course, your cortisol is going to spike and you're going to struggle. So get little things like that out of the bedroom. Or if you have any blinking lights on TV, ideally there's no TV, you know, in your bedroom, but if you really need TV to fall asleep, some people, if they find it doesn't disrupt them and they enjoy that, then, you know, carry on. But do make sure that there aren't any, you know, blinking lights or things like that that could impair your sleep. And then look at the foundation of your sleep, which is your bed and your pillows. and ask yourself, is my bed, is my mattress supportive? Are my pillows supportive? And by the way, these things don't have to break the bank. So if you really, you're waking up with pain due to your mattress, or it's not supportive, or it's too hot, all of those things can be remedied. And again, they don't have to change, break the bank. So a really good mattress could, cost it maybe, even $800 or $1,000. It's an investment, but I think often people will spend that on shoes, faster than they will.
Absolutely.
So I'm 100% in agreement that the bedroom is an integral part of our healthy sleep schedule.
Yeah, I definitely think it goes a long way. One thing I haven't touched on, which I think is really important, is what is your take on being on a device before bed? Because I've noticed when I was younger and I didn't have a cell phone, I would read a paperback before I went to bed, and I would honestly drift off so quickly. Now, if I want to read, I admit I typically am not reading a paperback. I'm on my phone, and I'm finding it like it's less soothing now before I just kind of fall asleep to the, the pages. But now there is that blue light. Do you recommend not being on devices before bed? And if you do recommend that, when should we shut them off?
This is a really great question. And we do have some evidence to show that a lot of us are on our screens virtually until the moment we're falling asleep. Now, what's going on those screens is damaging for two reasons. The first is likely what you're looking at is stressful. You're maybe scrolling social media, and maybe, hopefully not, but maybe you're seeing your friends do something that you weren't part of. And then that causes your heart to sink. And so now we're experiencing negative emotion right when we want to be falling asleep. It could also be emails or stressful things about work. So if you're going into your phone, maybe to use something like a meditation app or, find a source of positive emotion, that could be one thing. But generally speaking, our phones can be wonderful devices, but kind of sources of things that aren't ideal when we're trying to fall asleep. So keep in mind that it's not only, what we're doing, but then there also is blue light that's being emitted from that device into your eyes and the cognitive home for our internal circadian rhythm that in part governs our sleep and wake systems. That region of the brain is right behind the eyeball. And so that blue light enters the brain through the eyes and then signals to the brain, basically, that you're outside on a bright sunny day, because that the brightness from the screens is really that strong. So there are ways to ameliorate attenuate the impact of screens on sleep, such as using night shift if you have an iPhone, or lowering the brightness. But the key with any of those tools, night shift or other platforms like that on the Android, that will change the screen color temperature. So it's not just reducing the brightness, because just reducing the brightness it won't remove the blue spectrum light from the screen. It will just make it less bright blue, but it's the blue spectrum light the most damaging. So the beauty of night shift and the other type of functionalities that are offered on Android is that they are changing the temperature of the color that's being emitted from your screen. So if you have to be on your smartphone, do look into those platforms. Flux is another one on a computer, if you, again, have to be on that screen before bed. And this is for, my parents out there that put the kids to bed and have a work deadline. And, this stuff does happen. So think of those tools if you do have to be on screens. But unfortunately, what our data do show is that when we compare Elisa now to Elisa, your lovely story about when you were young, to you when you were young and reading paperback books, we have a study that did exactly that. So we had two conditions of people. One was using a light emitting tablet, and another was given a paperback book. Both conditions were asked to read for a while before bedtime. And then they went into a rigorous overnight sleep evaluation where we measured all sorts of aspects of their sleep. And what we found is that those that were reading from the light emitting ebook, those individuals had a longer time to fall asleep. And believe it or not, the structure of their sleep changed. So they actually spent a little bit less time in rapid eye movement sleep. So one of the most important sleep stages for our cognitive abilities. So important things to keep in mind there. And in a perfect world, we're off screens, ideally, at least 30 minutes before sleep, if not up to about 60.
Okay, that is great to know. And I mean, I myself have experienced that, but these days I'm like, it's actually pretty hard to find a paperback. So that study is super interesting.
Yes.
And definitely corroborates with my own experience. This is a question that
a library membership could be great. Anyone who's on a budget, go find your local library and get on their list of, you know, new arrivals and go pick up a library book. You know, again, this stuff doesn't have to be expensive, but these small changes go a long way. But that's, of course, Elisa, if people enjoy reading before bed, because one of the key recommendations is jam packing the time before bed with things that you love and that soothe you. So if it's reading a paperback book, wonderful, you know, carry on. If it's practicing a relaxation strategy, that's another wonderful strategy, or taking a warm bath. So there are lots of different options. But the key is really filling that time at least 30 minutes before bed. You know, you've served other people. If you're a mom, you've taken care of those kids. If you're, you know, a busy employee, or you've been doing things for others probably all day, serving others, issuing reports, responding to emails. And so take back those minutes before bedtime. That is your time to set yourself up and get the rest that your body and brain so desperately need.
Okay, that's awesome. The question that I want to know, well, there's a couple that I personally really want to know, but one of the most interesting ones, because I couldn't find anything definitive when I was doing some research, is can you actually catch up on sleep or bank sleep? So I've been using another sleep tracking app recently, and it gives me a sleep credit. And that, you know, when I get like more than 8 hours, it essentially goes into a bank, like a bank account. And then when I've slept less than 8 hours, then it takes away. So right now I have like a 5% bank credit. Is that something that is backed by science? Can we bank sleep, catch up on sleep?
Great question. The term sleep banking came about through research with the military. So this was some work that sleep scientists did to ask, or, you know, determine how to best support military personnel when they're on missions that might take longer than 24 hours. And so this concept of sleep banking came about because there is a little evidence to show that if you are going into a period of a period of time that you know will be marked by sleep deprivation, whether that's not getting enough sleep because of exams, if you're a student, or if you have a busy time for work coming up, what you might do is preemptively really double down on a healthy sleep schedule. Basically, make sure that you're going to bed about 15 or 20 minutes a little bit earlier than you typically do, building in lots of time to relax and unwind before bed, and really set yourself up for success when it comes to sleep. And what that will do is we'll put a little bit more sleep in your bank account, so to speak, so that you are a little bit more buffered when you go into that period of sleep deprivation. Now, the other side of the coin is the fact that if we are in that period, in a period of time when we are not able to meet our nightly sleep need, say you personally, you mentioned, Elisa, that you need 9 hours of sleep to operate at your full capacity. So say you are in a period of time where, you know, work is a lot and you're only able to get, you know, six or seven hours, let's say. So let's do the math there. That's 2 hours away every night from your nightly sleep need. Now that delta does not just dissipate. So it's not as though we can take away time from our sleep and just magically add hours to our waking day. And that's a myth, because that sleep need is a biological fundamental need. And if we fall short of it, we've got to make it up. And so, God forbid you're behind the wheel of a car or in a safety critical environment when you are cutting yourself short on sleep, because sleep is a biological response. When we're not getting enough, our body and our brain will work to get it. And unfortunately, that can be at undesirable times, such as in environments like when you're driving an activity that's relatively monotonous. Maybe the car is a little bit warm and it's the perfect recipe for falling asleep. So do be mindful of that. Anyone who's listening, if you are not getting enough sleep, unfortunately, it can come at times that are, again, not desirable. So the key is being aware of that that difference, the difference between the sleep that you're getting and the sleep that you know you need. And so if you're in one of these periods where, you know, work is flaring, or you're a mother to a newborn or a father to a newborn, be mindful that you will really need to find a time to make up that lost sleep. Ideally with naps in the afternoon is a great way to do that. So say you're falling short, at least in your case, of your 9-hour target, you're getting 7 hours, say, for a 1 week of work. And just be mindful that when Saturday or Sunday rolls around, you're going to be exhausted. So resist sleeping in, because what sleeping in does is it starts to give our brain input that we're trying to adjust to a new time zone. It thinks you've hopped in a plane and flown to London. And so instead of kind of repaying that sleep debt, that's actually, you know, it will in part repay your sleep debt, but it will also start to shift you to a new time zone. Whenever we extend our bedtime or our rising times by more than an hour, this process of shifting starts, such that the next night rolls around and we've all been there. Suddenly you have Sunday night insomnia because you slept in until, you know, noon or several hours past your typical wake up time on Sunday. So the key is making it up strategically, resisting the urge to sleep in wherever possible, and making up that sleep loss with a nap in the afternoon would be ideal. About 20 minutes if you're short on a sleep, on just a little bit of sleep. But if you're really cutting sleep short, then you're going to need closer to 90 minutes, more of what we'd call a siesta.
I was just going to ask, you took the words out of my mouth, how long a nap should be. So that's amazing. Is that something that people should set? And should people set an alarm when they're napping, or is it just sleep as long as your body tells you it should?
No, that's a really good question. The duration recommendations are quite specific, because I'm sure we could all agree that we've all taken a nap that maybe lasted 3 or 4 hours. And, you know, when you were home from college, or, you know, those naps that just would cause you to wake up and be totally disoriented and then ruin the next night's sleep and the next night. So the duration recommendations for naps are actually quite specific. We really want to be falling asleep within about, or sleeping for about 20 minutes. And that's in the case, we call that a power nap. And that will give you a little bit of rest that will give you an extra hour or two of wakefulness. But then in the case, if you're really burning the candle at both ends, try a nap closer to 90 minutes of duration, in duration, excuse me.
That's amazing. A couple things with nutrition, our nutrition tracker, and sleep. So I've read that there are some nutrients that support sleep. Some of those, when I did the research, we actually have a nutrition scientist here, and she helped me out with this one. Our omega-3s are good for sleep. Vitamin D is good for sleep. But there are some nutrients that have the opposite effect. I would love to hear your thoughts on both caffeine and sleep, and alcohol and sleep.
Yes, these are two areas where nutrition and sleep are two, you know, areas where sleep is certainly impaired. So caffeine consumption, but I will say before all of this, is if you are, you know, having a minimal amount of alcohol or a minimal amount of caffeine, and you're not impacted negatively by these two substances, then you might not have a problem. But if you're having a high amount of caffeine over the course of the day, and you feel that your heart rate is elevated and you're struggling to fall asleep at night, those could be signs that you're maybe having too much, because the literature is quite clear. Caffeine is a drug, and it does have something called a half-life. It will stay in your system well beyond the time that, you know, the period that you were consuming it. So yes, it gives us a jolt, but then it lasts in our system and can linger, increasing your heart rate and impacting us otherwise for, believe it or not, between 6 and 9 hours. And we're all differentially susceptible to caffeine. Some people can drink caffeine and go right to sleep. There are few of those people, but they're out there. But then others are highly susceptible. So any caffeine they drink could linger in their system for several hours. So one of the key things is figuring out where you are and learning, you know, determining your you know, drop dead deadline for no more caffeine. For me, I'm very susceptible. So I can have one in the morning, with lunch or right after lunch, and that's all. And I'm careful that they're two small cups, because caffeine, believe it or not, they're in a small cup of coffee, about 8 ounces. If you're near to any vessel of, you know, liquid currently, that's a tiny cup of coffee, by the way, but that
it's not big at all.
And by the way, it's hard to even get an 8 ounce cup of coffee in America. I don't think any of the small, like Dunkin' Donuts, Starbucks, all of their smallest are bigger than 8 ounces. So just be mindful of how much you're drinking. Cause sometimes people will say, oh, you know, I just have one in the morning, but then we look at their cup and it's like, you know, 48 ounces. And so that is enough because each serving is kind of it lingers for an additional period of time. So if you're chugging 30 ounces of coffee in the morning, that could definitely be lingering by the time bedtime rolls around if you're drinking enough. So just be mindful of how much you're drinking and when it comes to caffeine. Now, alcohol. It's a little bit of a myth that alcohol in a nightcap is a good thing for your sleep, but it's confusing because alcohol has sedative properties. So it will put you to sleep or it will help you fall asleep. But unfortunately, that comes at a price. It disrupts the subsequent sleep you experience that night. And there is evidence that even a small glass of wine or a beer, even one glass or dose is enough to have a small impact. On average, that it's about a 9% ding to your sleep quality. And then each additional dose is another such kind of hindrance to our sleep quality. So two drinks is on average 25% reduction in our sleep quality. And that's because this substance causes us to wake up after we fall asleep. So it results in a fragmented night of sleep and basically us waking up and feeling unrefreshed. So again, just be mindful when you're drinking, how much you're drinking. If you're experiencing any issues, you might try to cut it out and just notice how your sleep improves.
For me, I drink alcohol maybe once a year. And so I found it so fascinating to have wearable data. At the time I was wearing my Oura ring, and I just noticed, you know, like how much higher my resting heart rate was, because typically my resting heart rate in the evening when I'm sleeping is anywhere from like 45 to 50 beats a minute. And the day that I had consumed alcohol, it was at like 65. And there was no other things that really pointed towards having a negative impact. You know, I didn't run the day that day. I didn't have excess caffeine or anything. And I was like, oh my goodness, like I must be very affected by this. So I can't imagine what my own body would do if I was doing that regularly. So for me, like once again, the data, it was just so interesting to see what science is telling me is actually happening in my own body. So that was pretty interesting.
Yes. And that's everything, right? And that's the behavior change that we were talking about that's so powerful when you do engage in something that maybe isn't great for your nutrition, your sleep, your health. And then you notice you have the data to show you like, wow, you probably noticed, Elisa, there are probably more awakenings. You might not have felt so great in the morning. So again, that's the most powerful behavior change when you can come to those insights on your own.
Absolutely. And then I'm like, this actually supports my desire to not consume alcohol. So that's perfect.
I love it. Lisa, you're an all-star sleeper. No alcohol, early bedtime. I love it. The full night hours. You're doing great.
I am basically an 85-year-old when it comes to sleep. But it's so funny. Just, you know, hearing like,
you'll probably live forever.
Well,
yeah, I'm 85.
That would be wonderful. But it's just so funny because I just think back to my childhood and my parents being like, Elisa, Megan, get into bed. And then I'd be like fighting it, you know, wanting to stay up. And now I'm like, there is no problem for me to go to bed. One of the things that I wanted to discuss as well is, so we talked about the general population, you know, hopefully getting 7 to 9 hours. How does that change, or does it change for people who are into long endurance sports? So I'm talking about like people who compete in triathlons or ultra marathon runners. Does that need to change for them?
Great question. Now, this admittedly is not my direct area of expertise. I have read a couple of these papers though, and basically it does show that really hardcore endurance athletes that are exercising for long periods of time can face sleep challenges. Simply, they if they're not getting enough nutrition and their bodies are, you know, starved for food still, their sleep can sometimes suffer. I have heard kind of anecdotally and read some reports that that group in particular can struggle. So I think the findings have highlighted making sure that nutrition is appropriate in those condition, in those situations, but then also realizing that your sleep duration might increase a little bit if you're in that category of endurance athlete. And so being mindful and trying to meet that need and realizing that it might change when you're training for something versus when you're maybe tapering or not leading up to a big tournament or race.
I find on days that I'm running a lot that I would assume that I would have an easier time falling asleep, but almost the opposite has been true for me. I find it quite difficult to fall asleep. I'm not sure if it's like the adrenaline or the rush, but I find it actually harder to sleep because maybe something in my mind is just, you know, the endorphins from the runner's high are just flowing. The other things that I thought was interesting, there's four stages of sleep, right? Am I correct in saying that?
Correct.
Okay, perfect. So I get all of this data from my wearable and it's talking about, you know, periods of wakefulness, deep sleep, lighter sleep. What do those numbers mean? And is there one I should be focusing on trying to get more of, you know, like when I'm looking at my own numbers, I'm not getting a ton of deep sleep. And I do dive into this and read that it can be a pretty individualistic number, if I'm not mistaken. But how would I work on increasing those, that restorative sleep?
Well, really good question. So on the latter part of that question about restorative sleep, we've published a little bit on that topic. And after discussing this in depth with colleagues in sleep science, then we reached the conclusion that restorative sleep is really something that's in the eye of the beholder. So it's restorative, and restoration from sleep really comes from self-report. It's really this notion of you wake up and you feel better. And so I'd start with that in my answer to your wonderful question, because part of this, or my reaction, or my response, is that do take the quantitative data with a bit of a grain of salt and truly think about how you feel when you wake up. Do you feel ready and raring to go? Then that, to me, would indicate that your sleep was restorative. Now, the sleep stages, yes, there are four. Sleep is generally separated into rapid eye movement sleep and non-rapid eye movement sleep.
Okay.
Rapid eye movement sleep, that's comprised of three stages, 1, 2, and 3. And stage 3 sleep is where our brain slows completely, or not completely, but slows significantly. And the pens of the electrodes, if I was measuring you in our laboratory here in Boston, would look and sound like you're asleep. So very low frequency brain waves, high amplitude, it's the distance from peak to trough, really looking and sounding again like. It's the closest thing that we as human beings get to hibernation. And that's where all of our muscular regeneration comes into play, and you know, the deep rest that we kind of stereotypically think about sleep. Now, in the rapid eye movement stage of sleep, our brain is firing, lighting up like a Christmas tree. And it's fascinating because that's the time where dreaming takes place. And we're starting to believe that dreaming plays this really important role in integrating memories that we take in from the day into our longer-term storage and transferring short-term memories to longer-term memories and encoding them within our existing networks. So the research on dreaming is fascinating, but it's a little bit of a sense of what all those stages are and what they mean. And then the other interesting thing is that we cycle in and out of those stages in this really rhythmic, beautiful process. So in the beginning of the night, we enter stage 1, 2, 3, and then REM, and then we cycle again through that whole process. And then again, a healthy sleeper will go through about 4 or 5 such cycles. Now, a typical night for a healthy sleeper will be also split up such that the first half of the night is awash in deep sleep, and the second half of the night is awash in rapid eye movement sleep. So we spend a little bit more in those two stages, again, deep in the first half and then REM sleep in the second half of the night. So again, that's just a little bit of a kind of some background for the stages. The key thing to keep in mind is that if you're doing everything right, if you're practicing healthy sleep hygiene, all the tips and strategies that we're talking about, your brain will take care of the rest. So often people are like, what do I do to boost my, you know, stage one or stage two or, you know, what have you? And the truth is, if you're doing all of this behavioral stuff right, your brain will take it from there. But that being said, there are things that we can do during the day or avoid to set ourselves up for success when it comes to getting the appropriate amount of sleep. We did touch on this a little bit, but alcohol is a major disruptor of sleep. So it disrupts the whole night, but it will reduce the time that we spend in rapid eye movement sleep, in part because we're waking up during that stage. So keeping alcohol to a minimum, getting exercise. Exercise releases endorphins. It helps with stress. It helps us really sleep into a little bit of a deeper state of relaxation. So that can help unplugging from screens. We talked about that a little bit, but using screens, doing hardcore, you know, computer work and all of this stuff up until the moment we want to be falling asleep, that will hinder our ability to you know, get the full architecture of beautiful sleep. So those are a couple key things to keep in mind. But the bottom line is the tracker data is really strong and it's only getting stronger. All these companies are really focused on delivering, you know, really highly accurate product. But again, mm-hmm. take them with a grain of salt and do realize that how you feel, although old school, low tech, is also a great barometer of the extent to which your sleep is restorative.
That's amazing. I was so curious because when I started tracking my sleep with Aura, I was like, you learn so much off the bat, and you actually touched on one of my questions that I was going to follow up with, was how accurate are these things? Because I, in the nature of our business, I have worn three things that track sleep at the same time. I had on my Aura ring, I had on a Whoop device, and then I had on my Apple Watch, and they were all close, pointed to the same trends, but not identical. So it's I love that you already answered my question, and that is to obviously pay attention to your body and that they're not 100% accurate yet. But and that's improving. Part of
it. Yes. Well, I say that for two reasons, because yes, the data are, but I will say they are extremely robust. We used to mm-hmm. have critiques with a lot of the available trackers about, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, but now the data is getting to be really strong. And so, but nevertheless, it's still technology. It's not going to be absolutely perfect. So if you're like, wait, did I wake up last night? You know, maybe you didn't, but the tracker detected an awakening. So maybe take them with a grain of salt in that respect, but really also because that is just one piece of feedback about your sleep. And so really also thinking about taking those objective data with a grain of salt vis-a-vis just the fact that when you wake up and how you feel is also just an integral component of, or, you know, metric of how well you did the night before.
So what I do now, which is interesting, basically corroborates what you're saying, is before I would wake up and I would immediately grab my phone and I would, you know, check out to see how good my sleep was. This is when I was running quite a bit and my running performance was determined in large part by my sleep. But now I actually take a moment, I wake up, and then I'm like, how does my body feel about this today? And then I will look at, you know, the sleep app data, basically just kind of confirm. So I'm not relying wholly on what something is telling me. I'm doing a gut check, so to speak, before I'm looking at that. So I think that that's been pretty beneficial for me, just getting the feel of my body before something tells me what I'm feeling.
I love that.
I have one more question, and that is about people that are taking melatonin. Can we just touch on melatonin? Because I know I'm friends with a number of people who do shift work. And that means that the one set they're off and they're working days, and then the next shift they're on nights. And it's pretty challenging from what they're telling me to adjust. So a lot of them are taking melatonin to fall asleep faster. Mm. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, shift work is probably an area where melatonin might be okay. The one thing with melatonin, it's really not a sleep aid. I think it's marketed that way and kind of marketed as this panacea for anyone who's experiencing sleep difficulties, but it's really not. It's really for someone who's experiencing kind of a circadian rhythm issue. And many shift workers do experience exactly that. Basically, they have one sleep routine when they're working and another sleep schedule when they're not working. And that is unfortunately not ideal for our health. It does set us up for some concerns vis-a-vis our risk for chronic conditions and other outcomes if we're not careful and able to manage the shift. And the key thing is when it comes to shift work is doing your best to work with your manager and have at least a predictable set of shifts. So if you're, you know, doing an overnight, you at least know that it's coming and you can prepare for it adequately and then recover adequately. So melatonin might be appropriate in those situations. Of course, it's something to talk to your healthcare provider about whenever you're considering a new treatment, just to make sure it doesn't interact with anything you're already taking.
Amazing.
Did that answer your question, Alisa?
That absolutely did. Okay. Yeah. And I said that was my last one, but I actually do have one more. And I always like to try to end the podcast with one recommendation from the professional on an action item they can do today to improve whatever area expertise I'm interviewing on. So if you had one tip that you could tell people, everyone that's listening, to do tonight, what would that number one thing be?
The number one thing tonight, I think, you know, we talked about so many good ones, but I think one of the big things for me is really mindset around sleep. And I say that for two reasons. First, mindset, in that because sleep is this very different health behavior than others, and that sometimes, you know, stress can keep creeping and all of us can experience issues from time to time. But I think self-talk about sleep is really important. So if you experience any of those difficulties, taking them in stride, you know, if you're having a hard time falling asleep, or maybe you wake up and you can't fall back asleep, that is the time to really kind of coach yourself and say, you know what, I got this, no big deal. You know, I'm going to get up, I'm going to bathroom, and I'm going to come back and try again. And if sleep doesn't come, so if you're kind of in bed 20 or 30 minutes, either difficulty falling asleep, or you wake up and can't fall back asleep, that is when you get your butt out of bed and do something with the lights low. And this is a big myth that staying in bed will be better. You know, staying in bed, you'll get some sleep, better to stay there than get out. Wrong. All of our data show that if you stay in bed, you start to kind of condition yourself that your bed is where you experience insomnia, where you toss and turn. So we break that cycle by leaving the bed. Keep the lights low and do some gentle yoga poses or breathing exercise. I can't say enough good things about these simple exercises that are really excitedly starting to catch on through social media and other channels. But the 478 breath technique is one. It was developed in the military and has now kind of become mainstream. It's where you breathe in for 4 seconds. And then you hold your breath for 7 seconds. That's a long time. And then you exhale slowly for 8 seconds. And that is so beautiful because you're so focused on these long durations of holding and exhaling that all of the thoughts in your mind can just wash away. So building those exercises in whenever you're experiencing any difficulties is one thing I'd like to end on.
I love that. This is my favorite episode I've done yet. Honestly,
oh my
it is.
Gosh, I'm so honored, Alisa.
You speak so beautifully. Your voice is also very soothing.
You're so kind. My friend Kelly Ripa and Ryan Seacrest are so funny. Whenever I'm on their show, they're always like, but your voice, just come back and talk to us, please.
Honestly, if you could just read me a bedtime story every night, I don't think I'd ever have an issue falling asleep. It's so lovely. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
This is absolutely wonderful.
We learned so much about sleep from Dr. Rebecca Robbins. If you'd like to follow her work, you can find her at www.rebecca-robbins.com, on Instagram at Dr. Rebecca Robbins, and Twitter at Rebecca S. Robbins. If you want to learn more about your nutrition and health, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, and we'll see you next time.